Morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we're going to be dealing with a variety of condiments, we will call them. I just thought of something very clever.
Go ahead, my dear. Do something very clever.
I can't remember it.
I can't remember what it was.
It was condiments is to cooking what something is to something else, but I can't remember what the other.
Okay, well, never mind.
Anyhow, that's all right.
We were very surprised when we interviewed the people from this farm in Georgia until we remembered that ex-president Jimmy Carter was a peanut farmer in Georgia. So the Oliver Farm people, they apparently know Jimmy Carter's family very well, and they've been at it in Georgia growing a variety of nut-type products for a long time, but they decided to get into it in a much bigger and much more sophisticated way recently. Really a very interesting story.
We love their green peanut oil, for example.
We love all their oils. We've tried the Benny oil.
Let's listen to Clay Oliver. We received the most amazing oils from a farm called Oliver Farm, and we're talking to Clay Oliver. And Clay, you have a history to this farm. It's a family farm, is it not?
Yes, ma'am, it is. I'm actually the fifth generation to operate the farm.
Wow.
A little over 100 years old.
Wow. And you produce what? Tell me what you do on your farm.
Well, for the longest time, our farm typically grew mainly row crops, cotton, corn, peanuts, the commodity crops, and that was dictated on prices and our rotation, and we also have cows. But in the past 4 years, we began growing oil seeds and then pressing them on the farm to make oils. We do a cold press so it retains the flavor and the nutrients of the oil.
Now, what made you make that change? It sort of seems like agriculture in Georgia must be sort of pretty historical. So it's a sort of a sudden change. You say, well, we just changed our minds about 4 years ago.
Well, it actually began in about 2008. If you remember, that's the year that the recession began.
Yes, indeed.
There were a lot of people losing their jobs, and the news had pieces on it frequently about biofuel and alternative fuels. And I began to thinking, you know, is there a way that we could grow something and turn it into a fuel and supplement our cost, or, you know, just be more sustainable? And through that learning process and research that I did, I got turned on to making food-grade oil on the farm. And, you know, trying to sell directly to consumers from the farm what we made here.
Now, is everything that you make into an oil, is it all grown on your farm?
It was initially, but we've kind of reached the point now that we can't physically do it all.
Got it.
And that allows us to source from our neighbors. And people who specialize in growing pecans or peanuts, and we can get, you know, really high quality fresh seeds and nuts and process them the way we do. It just makes a great product.
Oh, great is wonderful. I mean, what got my attention is you've won a lot of awards, haven't you?
Yes, well, fortunately we have gotten some attention and people recognizing that it is a good product, and I'm very blessed to have gotten into with the Good Food Award people. They've just been a great help to us and tremendous outlets that they provide.
Yeah, the one that I really noticed first off the bat was you have a green peanut oil, and I had never heard of that. And you sent us some of that, and we tried it, and it was spectacular, absolutely spectacular. Peter makes this one sort of a pork chop stew thing that he's made it, I don't know how many times, but when we used that peanut oil, it made a flavor difference like you can't imagine.
Now, let's drill down a little bit. Why is it called green peanut oil? I mean, the peanuts are are raw, but peanuts are really nuts anyway. So what's the secret behind the name?
Well, we work closely with some chefs, and one of them nearby in Atlanta, Stephen Satterfield,
We've interviewed Stephen. Oh, really? Yeah. We know him.
Okay. Well, Chef Satterfield just kept tasting it and saying, man, this is green. It tastes so fresh. And he started calling it green peanut oil, and he was actually on Mind of a Chef on PBS, and he said it on air. And when people request the oil, they want the green peanut. And so we market it that way so that you know that there's something different about our oil.
Yeah, it is different.
You know, if you're not familiar with it, most peanut oil that you would buy commercially has been processed, and they go through high temperatures. Oftentimes, you're not using the highest quality nut when you're looking to make commercial-grade oil, where on the other hand, we use really high-quality nuts that have been shelled really recently, and then we do a cold press that just retains that flavor that just, it just pops.
Got it. Now let's go over the whole portfolio, because we've talked about green peanut oil. Anne's mentioned pecan oil.
I was talking about the flour, which is a whole other category.
Okay.
But we also have used the Benny oil, and I'm trying to remember what it was. It was something really special we were doing, and we used that. The Benny oil, and it was really good too.
Then you've got sunflower oil.
We do. We grow all of our sunflower oils or our sunflower seed here on the farm, and that was the first that we did because that's what I dreamed of making the biofuel with, and we found that it's a really versatile oil. It has a high smoke point, higher than olive oil. You can use it as salad dressings because it has that great toasty, nutty flavor. And it's also suitable as a frying medium. So if you do want to saute or fry something, here's a healthy oil that you can use.
Now, what distinguishes the infused oils?
Well, those are some oils that we do too. We do sunflower, and we do one with the green peanut, and we add herbs and spices to the oil. And initially it was just a family thing that we did ourselves, and it became so popular, people requested it, that we just said, well, let's put it out there. And actually the herb-infused sunflower oil is about our second most popular oil.
Oh, indeed.
People like it as a salad dressing. You shake the bottle up, pour it out. You've got a bread dip.
Oh, that's
makes
great.
A great marinade. And I'm pretty fond of using it with potatoes.
Oh, that sounds
potatoes.
Good.
Yeah.
Anything with potatoes is good as far as I'm concerned.
That's right.
Let's do this live. I have some fresh Pacific cod tonight. And I'm going to probably put some turmeric on it like I did the other night, but then I'm going to put some onions in the pan after that and cook it up. Which oil should I use for that?
Oh gosh, I think you should do it about 3 or 4 nights a week and just try a different oil.
There you go. We'll flip a coin in the air to try and decide.
No. We touched a little on your flowers. Talk to us about what flowers you have in your inventory.
Well, in trying not to waste any of the product, and after we extract the oil, we said, well, hey, this is still a nice food-grade product here. So we found a way to extract enough oil from the byproduct to mill it then into really fine flour.
Really?
I wasn't pursuing this, but it just so happens that they're all gluten-free flours, and we found that there are some people who are really need these, and this offers them a tasty alternative to sometimes bland gluten-free flours. And then you're able to use it with white flour if you're not, trying to be gluten-free. And it gives a great flavor change, texture, the colors. As you've seen, the pecan flour is a dark, rich brown color. And it really bakes well, makes great sweets, and we're really crazy about our brownies that we make with the pecan
flour. Now, how do I get, do you have that recipe on your website?
The brownies? We do. Yes, ma'am. If you look under the flour tab, there should be, you should be able to see one there.
Now, what's the website? Let's get the website name out there.
Oh, yeah.
It's oliverfarm.com.
That's singular. Oliver, F-A-R-M.
Oliver, F-A-R-M, dot com.
Right. And do you have a store finder there that says this is where you're likely to be able to find it?
We do. We have a zip code finder that we find pretty handy that you can put in your zip code, and it shows you the stores near you, and you can scroll around and see where to located at.
Now, I wanted to ask you a take you in a slightly different direction here. We have some really good friends in California. The name of the company is Tourangeau.
Uh-huh.
And the owners are French. And their take on oils is most of their oils are roasted. Right, Liv?
I don't know.
Toasted pecan oils and all the different oils they make.
Yeah, roasted walnut.
As opposed to being cold pressed, have you thought of heading in that direction at all?
Well, we have had some requests to do some toasted oils, and we've played around with that a little bit. But mm-hmm. That's just another avenue we may pursue one day. But right now, the raw, untoasted oils are more popular for us.
Uh-huh. Well, it's this whole artisanal producer thing that we're in right now. Now, did you start out with offering your oils to chefs primarily?
Well, I like to think as many lines as you have in the water, you're liable to catch something. So we sought every avenue that was possible. We started doing farmers markets, local farmers markets. If we would hear of a chef, say, like Chef Stephen Satterfield, who was very open and into this kind of stuff, we reached out to them and whoever wanted to try some oil.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and what other chefs have you worked with?
Well, Chef Stephen Satterfield has passed along to his friends samples and gotten the word out. One of our good friends that uses a lot of oil is Rolf at Rolf and Daughters in Nashville, Philip Krajek. He has really supported us. There are Sean Brock.
Yeah, Sean's a good friend, yeah.
He has done a tremendous bit to promote us.
Is he going to rebuild the Nashville shop?
I'm not sure. I have not been there. I would like to visit there.
We used to cover the Nashville food and wine. We didn't do that last year, but that's always a great event.
But Sean had opened this new restaurant,
nice place.
And then it burned to the ground.
Oh my!
Yeah.
I tell you, a lady chef who has really helped us is Chef Holly Shute. She worked for many years in the Georgia Governor's Mansion, and now she is taking a role with the Department of Ag, and she's the liaison for products like me to get into restaurants and to retail places. She takes our stuff and passes it around and does demos and promotes it, and so she's done a lot to help us get out there, and she's a real asset to the state of Georgia in what she does.
Well, Mr. Clay Oliver, you're a real secret kind of guy. I'm not quite sure how I found you, but our tentacles do stretch out in a lot of different directions. But it's really amazing to picture an agricultural Georgia as opposed to a suburban and city center like Atlanta kind of Georgia.
Well, we used to buy those bags of pecans right at the side of the road, if you remember.
Yeah, we did. We did. We did indeed.
And of course, the what's it called? The Foodways, the Southern Foodways, is it?
Southern Foodways Alliance.
Yeah. I mean, that's very active. So I think Southern food is getting a lot of attention.
Yeah. It is. It seems to be, well, we've always thought it was really good, but it's getting a lot of attention from food critics and foodies all over, yeah. And I think it's a good thing.
Is that Sinclair and something chocolate from there?
I'm not familiar with them.
No, I might have the wrong state. I thought it was Georgia.
Somebody did tell us the other day that they were growing Benny seeds in southern states somewhere. But
yes,
you probably know that anyway. Maybe you're doing it yourself.
We do make a Benny oil, and actually it won a Good Food Award year in January. Yes.
But are you actually growing it? I mean, the people we talk to, they're actually making tahini in mm-hmm. Israel with
Benny seeds.
With sesame seeds grown in Ethiopia. But they did say that they had heard that people were growing Benny seeds in the southern states.
That's right. They are. There's a company out of, I believe it's Columbia, South Carolina, named Anson Mills.
Oh, sure,
we
sure,
know
sure.
Anson Mills. Yeah, they're great.
Okay, that's who I source my Benny from, and I
okay.
see it's very high quality. It's fresh. Like I said, it won a Good Food Award this year, and the people out in California were blown away at this, you know, just intense flavor that the Benny has.
Yeah, it's amazing. The same product, but different qualities give you such a, I mean, it's just so different. The quality of your oil is outstanding, Oliver, and I really am enjoying having it and meeting you and learning about what your intentions are. It's just delightful.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to tell our story a little bit, and I'm glad you like the oil. That's what makes us happy
yeah,
here.
And
that
very
people
handsome.
Like our product.
It's handsomely packaged too, yeah. because it looks very contemporary.
But it's a wonderful all-American story.
Yes.
And our country should be proud of you, and we are. So thank you so much for joining us today and telling us this wonderful story of a family farm all grown up.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Ann. I enjoyed it.
Thanks, Oliver.
So anyway, having spent some time talking about nut oil, right after the break, we're going to talk about a fruit oil, because guess what? You didn't even think of it. Olives are fruits.
Oh, yes.
And anyway, that's getting ahead of ourselves. We've got to take a break, and we'll be right back with olive oils and other products from Spain.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We're still in the mindset of condiments. This particular one takes us to Spain. We're going to be talking about cayenne. What does that mean? I don't know.
It's sort of like Omar Khayyam, which is I don't think we ever got an explanation of where the name came from.
But it's Spanish products, and you know these Spain has marvelous products,
this stuff is wonderful. I mean, yeah. Just to give you an idea, one of the bottles of olive oil comes with a dress.
Oh.
it actually has a black and silver cloth all over it, and a few sequins as well.
What's in the bottle?
The top's like a Maker's Mark bottle. It has like a wax top on it.
Uh-huh.
We haven't even opened it yet. I'm really concerned as to how to open it. It didn't come with instructions, but the one instruction we got from Natalia, who is the founder of this company, Khayyam, is all their stuff is really, really, absolutely top drawer, really good stuff. So you need to know about it.
Natalia Cabrera, you must have a wonderful life. You just got back from a fantastic trip, huh?
Yes, I did, indeed. Went to Spain and had a wonderful, wonderful time.
And your company is called?
My company is called Khayyam. It means Khayyam, which is in the south is where all of the olive oil, or the olive oil basin of the world, the largest producer of olive oil in Spain. So I decided to take that name, which represents a little bit my first love, if you may call it that.
Now, where were you born?
I was born in Madrid, but I was raised between Upper West Side Manhattan and Spain, and a little bit of a Moroccan influence in Melilla, North Africa.
Really? Yeah, my mother always loved Morocco. Yeah,
it's beautiful.
Yeah. How long have you had your company?
My company was created 4 years ago. We're going on 5 now.
Okay.
And, you know, the sole purpose of it was to bring a good olive oil. I've been eating in restaurants since I've been living here for 20 years now. Mm-hmm. And I just found that they didn't have good olive oil on their tables. And I was baffled. You know, we're talking about back in the day, you know, the top, you know, renowned chefs. And olive oil was just not even important to them, I guess. So after 20 years in corporate, in the corporate world, I decided to leave all that behind and start my journey and search for the best olive oil.
Well, of course, Spain.
And that's what we did.
Yeah, Spain is an obvious one. It's the largest olive producing country in the world, isn't it?
Yes, but not all olives are the same. And not all olives have the same qualities and characteristics.
Right.
We focus on a varietal called Picual, which is P-I-C-U-A-L.
Oh, I saw that on the bottle. So that's the kind of olive.
Yes, it's a variety. It's a type of olive. And I think we're very proud to say that we are the first importer and distributor in the New York metro area that focuses on this varietal on its own. It's been used a lot for blending, mixing, because it's got high organoleptic qualities. Polyphenols is one of the highest. We have a count of 600 to 675. Depending on the harvest season. And also it has very high polyphenols the polyphenols is very high, but it's also very good for you because the higher the polyphenols, the healthier the fruit is. So, you know, you want this. And also it has a very high smoke point, which chefs find it extremely helpful because when they need to do a stir fry, the olive oil does not smoke up. So they can cook without it getting bitter or, you know, affecting the taste of their food, of their real, you know, the basic of their ingredients.
Now, that's characteristic of this particular variety of olive.
Yes, that is correct. If you look at Arbequina and Oji Blanca and other varietals that are very common, the shelf life is shorter. They tend to get older faster. Picual has a 23-month shelf life. So even though we go harvest to harvest, our olive oils actually remain fresh for a longer period of time. Our chefs are starting to really recognize not only the relevance of this varietal, but the importance of their kitchen, regardless of their cuisine. So we work with Italian, French, Greek, and they're very well-renowned chefs, by the way. Some of them are star chefs.
Well, I mean, you say you have a highly curated list of top-of-the-line products, and the line includes olives, olive oils, vinegars, pimento, smoked pimenton.
Yes, we bring a pimenton from La Vera. From a very small family in Guacos de Yuste. You know, our mission is very simple. There's a lot of distributors and importers here that bring products from Spain. But, you know, we bring the best. We actually are curators. We don't settle by making a phone call and looking at the brand that everybody's bringing. We actually bring brands that no one has heard before.
Well, how do you find them?
Traveling.
Traveling. You just got back from an extended visit to Spain, and you pride yourselves also on regional products, right?
Yes.
The different regions of Spain.
Absolutely. Each region is known for their products. So, for example, pimenton comes from La Vera in Extremadura. Cual is from Jaén, Andalusia. Piquillo peppers from Navarra, north of Spain. You know, it's very important to identify where the regions are, what they produce, and then select the family or the producer that is an expert in that product or produce. It's very known that other countries buy the piquillos, they repack them, they put product of X country, and then they sell it. But my whole concept is, why buy it from another country when you can buy it directly through the right importer, right? Because that's what we do.
Yeah.
And buy it directly from where it's made.
Yeah, that
you
was
know,
a scandal a few years back where they were discovering Italian olive oils were really repackaged olive oils from Spain.
Yeah, well, they filled the boat up with olive oil, ship it over to Lucca.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And then
put it
in tins that don't say grown in Lucca. They say packed in Lucca.
It's actually, you know, it's pretty disturbing. And we just coming back from Spain, clearly we've been talking about this because we're very connected with our producers. My company, me, we have established a partnership with the second largest producer of piqual in Spain. We have their trust. They have our trust. And, you know, looking at the history of what they have done to the olive oil, it's pretty a disgrace. It's pretty much disgraceful and shameful. Why? Why take such a basic ingredient that should be used naturally? Why try to monetize from it, making it, the price doesn't change, right? Because you're still selling it expensive. But to raise your margins, you have to adulterate it.
Yeah, it's evil.
So,
Natalia, it's pure evil. I mean,
yeah,
look,
well,
what about putting,
starting to pick up on that.
What about putting sawdust into Parmesan cheese?
Awful.
It's everywhere.
Did you read the book, Fake Food, Real Food? I actually just got it.
I haven't read that yet.
To read it.
Where do you get that?
It's a very good book. I got it on Barnes & Noble.
I mean, who's the publisher?
The publisher, I'll tell you right now, the title of the book is Real Food, Fake Food.
Wow.
And it's published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Olmsted is the writer. Larry Olmsted is the writer. I mean, he touches a little bit on olive oil there, which I think is good. But I think it's just in general the food industry. You know, it's very conducive to imitation. And that's why, you know, if Spain produces certain items, why not buy them, whether you're an Italian chef, a French chef, and you're going to use these products, why not buy it from its native,
right.
You know.
Well,
you're not going to get Indian spices from Spain. That's ludicrous, right?
Right.
So Spain is very specific in what we produce. Our vinegars are the most underestimated, product that we produce in Spain. The vinegars in Montilla Moriles, next to the Sherry region. Very important families that are producing vinegar for 40, 50 years. But they're not commercialized here. And we actually started to bring them here, like Moscatel, Pedro Ximenez, but in different types,
yeah,
different
Pedro
years,
Ximenez.
Different crianzas.
You sent us a bottle of that, Pedro Ximenez.
Yes.
It's interesting. Here's a tip for you, although I'm not sure whether they would be a competitor or not. But you remember the guys who sent us the vermouth, the sweet vermouth?
Yeah.
The vermouth.
Right.
They grow Pedro Ximenez grapes, and they make a sweet vermouth out of it, and it's
fabulous.
It's all the way over on the Atlantic coast beyond Cadiz is where they're producing it.
Do you know it?
That is correct. That's the Sherry region. I forget his name.
It's Bodega.
I don't specialize on
Bodega
liquor.
Something or other.
Yeah, we interviewed him.
That's
a very good product.
It's interesting.
There's many bodegas down in that region. It's populated. You just have to find the product that you know is going to be a hit in the States, because that's another challenge. Spain produces a lot of things, but not all of them are a fit. So we've we focus on doing a lot of research by talking to chefs, meeting with chefs. Little by little, we are expanding our lines. So the vinegar creation came about through a producer in Montilla, Moriles, because we discovered that he was the first one with the largest range of Pedro Ximénez grape, but also Fino and Oloroso, which are other wines that are converted in vinegar. Don't forget, in Spain, the vinegar was considered an insult to the winemakers. So there's a funny little story with... Yeah, it was kind of they were like, what? This is, you cannot. So we're working with the son of one of the biggest wine fino makers in Jerez. And he told his father when he was young, Dad, I am going to start, like, can I buy from you a few barrels? I'm going to start making vinegar. The father basically disowned him. But yeah, no, the story is hilarious. He has a Mercedes packed outside of his bodega. And he says, this is a reminder of my father, because he gave the car to his brother. And his brother gave it to him. And he said, it's a reminder of how my father didn't want to believe in me. Mm-hmm. But I did believe that vinegar was the next best thing in our region. And he was the first one. And he's my partner. So we're very proud to work with these families and groups that are really conscientious about their product and how they grow it. Time they put in their land. There's a lot of love and a lot of responsibility, which we bring. We bring that purely in its integrity here to the chefs. And my focus is chefs. We don't do a lot in supermarkets or stores, not because we don't believe in that. It's just because we like to work with a market that has been, even though the chefs know what to buy, but there is a lot of distribution here that they don't care much about quality or origin. So they just package it up and make it a bulk ship, you know, vinegar, red wine vinegar, balsamic vinegar. Let's give it a name. Let's give it a region. Let's give it an origin. And that's what Cayán does. And, you know, we have a lot more information on our website. If you don't mind me naming it, it's
www.cayán.com.
KHAYYAN.com. And we have all the analytics on olive oil listed there, our vinegars, their origin and history, and the purpose of why we're here.
Yeah, you have a very nice logo, by the way. Whoever did your logo should be congratulated.
I did it. And the Ys represent their upside down one, because Cayán means the crossroads of caravan. It's where all the trade was, all the trade of Spain would come through Jaén, through the Mediterranean basin. There's two big ports in south of Spain, one in Algeciras and the other one in Malaga. So all of the big trade, the olive oil, the vegetables, all the fruits would go to Africa through Jaén. So the Ys represent an X, which is a crossroads of caravans and all the merchants travels. So
now, how does your product?
That's a little nuance.
How does your product line differ from? I can't remember what it's called now. From Jose Andres's Think Food Group.
Well, sure. Jose Andres is a chef, and Jose Andres is from the north of Spain. And even though he does have his olive oils, but he's very focused on canned foods. His line is a little, you know, it just differs a little bit from his approach. I think his products are good, very good. But we take it a little bit more, a step further, for example. Like, we just want to work with chefs of all kinds. You know, he does a lot for the consumer. I forget the word now, it's more gourmet. Gourmet line, and ours is more institutional line. We don't have as much product as he has, in the sense that, you know, he has a lot of canned small sizes. So because our focus is on chefs, our sizes are larger, we're bottled differently, and we just focus on a different market.
I see.
We had an interesting story about olive oil And I think the location was Murcia, which is on the
Murcia.
And we were actually introduced to the concept by someone who did wines of Spain rather than olive oils, but he talked about this olive oil they made and called Lacrima. And basically they picked the olives very, very late in the season, and they put them in great big pits, and then they put stones on top.
And let them
and they allow the weight of the stones on top to very gradually force the olive oil out of the olives. And they call
it lacrima.
Like
tears. They call it lagrima.
Yeah,
exactly.
Tears. Lagrima tears, correct.
It was excellent, excellent.
It was absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
But I want to share one thing with you. Just if you know this already, then we'll delete it from the interview. But when we were in Montes Moria, however you pronounce it, we actually went to
Montilla Moriles.
We went to a winery which produces a whole family of wines made out of the PX grape.
Do you remember the name of it?
I don't know. No, it was big. I know one of their wines was called Electrico, because the bodega the bodega was in an old electric power plant,
right,
in the village where they lived. But they told us the story of how PX grapes got their name, and they said, in fact, that the rootstock for the grapes was brought to southern Spain by a mercenary soldier called Peter Siemens, who was a German. And the Spaniards in southern Spain, who were they were getting all lined up to throw the Moors out of Spain, which is why he was there. That was his job. But he put a few cuttings of vines from where he lived, and the Spaniards, of course, couldn't figure out how to pronounce Peter Siemens. So gradually over time, it got corrupted to Pedro Jimenez, and then to PX. And I understand he told us that after phylloxera, the people in Montes Marias replanted PX, but the people who had been making sherry not too far away did not. They put in less rare grape varieties instead. And I thought that was very interesting. He was a funny guy.
Yeah,
there's a lot of very good bodegas in Spain.
Yeah.
There's a lot of great chefs in Spain. Is actually resurging in so many ways, and more so in the past 5 years.
We didn't go this year, but usually we cover that Madrid fusion. What is it? The one in San Sebastian?
Gastronomica.
The Gastronomica is what we cover.
La Gastronomica. I actually have a very good relationship with one magazine. It's called Olimerca, which I rely a lot on their feedback and give me some insight into what's going on in Spain. And it's a Spanish magazine. And we've been talking. I met with Nieves, and we were talking about how many Michelin stars are there now in Spain.
Oh, wow.
She mentioned that there are over 30 Michelin star restaurants. 30 Michelin stars aggregated within all the restaurants in Spain. And the three restaurants in Spain are among the top 10 and 7 among the world's 50 best restaurants.
Right. Yeah, I just got the Conroca cookbook, by the way. Have you seen that?
Yeah, isn't that amazing? I saw it. It's beautiful.
Yeah,
beautiful.
Well, we've interviewed him, too. He's... We interviewed
two of the brothers.
Two of the brothers, yeah. But there's so much going on in Spain. I just read the top 10 hottest restaurants in Madrid, and I never have been to any one of them, and we've eaten in Madrid a lot.
You should go to Vivo. Vivo is a very nice place. It's a great chef there. But there's another chef that is actually starting to show up. His name is Jesús Moral, from Taberna Miguel.
Uh-huh.
And why I like this chef, and also Daniel García Peinado, which is another chef
yes.
in Malaga,
right.
is they're doing a big, big push of olive oil, extra virgin olive oil, in their kitchen. And you would think that a lot of the chefs would be doing this, but none of them, you know, use extra virgin in their kitchen. It's right. just a funny thing. So there's been a big movement around that. And also what makes us, what our ingredients are about as a company, is that all these chefs rely on these basic ingredients. The salt, the paprika, the olive oil, the vinegars, and their exquisite cuisine is based on this. So after interviewing and meeting a lot of these chefs, these Michelin chefs, it's like, why, you know, why not bring these ingredients that are in the kitchen of these chefs to our chefs in America? Right. And that's really the point of it. Okay. That's really the essence of my company. And the little boat, my little logo on the boat is the little ship bringing things over of yeah. Mar Santa Maria. that's a good story there as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, it's a good story. Well, it's great getting to know you and your products.
Well, thank you.
And
thank you.
I'm sure you had a wonderful trip, Natalia. And
yeah, it was full of adventure, that's for sure.
So if you have any hot tips on where next to go in Spain, send me an email.
Okay. I will.
Thank
I will
you so
definitely.
Much.
And
thanks,
thank
Natalia.
You for having me on the
you.
Menu.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, we're talking about condiments, and we're talking about cooking, and there's probably no condiment in the world as important as salt. And
not only that, that's why the Romans taxed it. The ancient Britons probably
exactly.
taxed it, too.
But that was
because
they
needed it is essential.
Preserving.
Let me let you into a little secret. Anne had a conversation one day with one of the country's top chefs. I won't tell you who it was, but it's a name you'd recognize. And she asked him a question out of the blue. She said, "Can you smell salt?" And he said, "Yes, I can." And Anne said, "And I can too." And it bewilders me because I don't know how she smells salt. The only thing I figured out was that whenever I brought her a sauce to see if it was any good, she would just say, "It'd be fine if you had a little salt
and acid." but remember the interview, folks. That chef in San Diego, we asked her, what was the hardest thing to teach her novice cooks? And she said how to salt properly, because that's so essential.
There you go. So
anyhow, so we're going to be talking to Leslie Bildirack, and she's
wrote a book, a definitive book all about
it's
salt.
It's called Salt. Leslie Bildirack, you have such a solid background in all things culinary, particularly in pastry. But your latest book, you've written a number of books, is called Salt, The Essential Guide to Cooking with the Most Important Ingredient in Your Kitchen. It's a very expansive book. I mean, you've expanded on the subject to all kinds of things. What was your interest in salt?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I took a trip to Austria and
I was getting shudders reading about that. I mean, I could think of nothing that I would rather less do than go zooming under in some tunnel.
It was amazing. I mean, there are huge lakes in the middle of a mountain, inside a mountain, where you can sail on a boat across the lake in what was a salt mine. But it fascinated me, and having been a classically trained chef, I was taught always kosher salt. And so for years, when I was teaching, I would make my students taste kosher salt against regular table salt, and they would really see the difference in that. And then once I started to find these different salts around the world, first in Austria, and then wherever I would travel, I would try to pick up salt. Then Fleur de Sel got very popular, and Maldon got very popular, and I started to really have preferences. And so it just kind of snowballed from there, and now I have a huge cupboard full of salt from around the world, which I love.
You keep all of them on hand?
I do, and I use them at work, to finish off pastries or finish off truffles or to enhance any kind of plating that I'm doing. But then I started to read more and learn more about where they were made and how they were made and the different foods that were used and the different cultures that use them, and I'm just was fascinated by it, so I was hooked.
You cited Mark Kurlowski's book. It's a genius book, isn't it?
Yes, it's a great book. Also, Mark Bitterman has a great book on
salt.
We
interviewed him about that, the book.
Yeah, and his shop, The Meadow, is a great resource. I buy through him very often, and also Postage in New York City I get my stuff from when I'm not just picking it up around the world.
You say, what is salt? Now, that should be a rather straightforward question and answer. NaCl.
Right, sodium chloride.
But you have salt and economics, salt and spirituality, sea salt. What else? Rock salt, salt lakes.
Right.
and on.
It all comes from the same place. It all comes from the ocean. But what ocean, where? What ocean, when? Ancient oceans that are long gone and have been pushed down through plate tectonics, the salt is still there. It's still from the ocean, but it takes on the different minerals and the different flavors of flora and fauna, whatever sea life is there. And so you really do have quite a range of flavors, and most people are kind of surprised to learn that because you just think salt is salt and it tastes salty.
Yeah, people do that. I mean, that's what they say.
I know.
I told you about the legendary argument I had with the scientist.
Right. I spend a lot of time making people sit down with me and try salt on a cucumber and compare them back and forth. I think every time I have a dinner party, I have to bring out salt tasting.
Oh, do you?
Because to me, for sure. Because to me, it's really an eye-opening experience. And if you have a passion for food and you like taste and you like to eat, then I think it's just a natural progression for you to start to, investigate all of the different salts. Because, I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of different flavors and types and colors and textures of salt, which, for even the great chefs that I know and work with are always surprised to find what is available in the world of salt.
And you say that there are new ones being discovered all the time.
Well, and people are opening up their own places. Like there's, especially in the Pacific Northwest, and I guess also on the Eastern Seaboard, there's a lot of places that people are starting to do little artisan salt works. There's a place in the Caribbean, I want to say it's in the Caymans, where they started a salt works just to help revitalize after a hurricane struck down a few years ago. And it's really helping to, boost that economy. Artisan salt from, whatever area has a different flavor. So it's becoming quite a thing.
Well, it certainly has. It's become, I mean, anyhow, I told you that I did a salt tasting with a group, including some chefs.
Right.
And afterwards, the Portuguese chef said he felt like a bacalá salt caught. And that was quite a bit of salt, but we didn't taste it on foods. We tasted it on its own, and we got to cleanse our palates with water and either dry bread or crackers or something in between.
Well, I usually like to do, if I'm pre-planning a salt tasting, I will offer several really plain foods, but definitely foods and different types. So, for instance, a cucumber, maybe a piece of grilled steak, plain, maybe a piece of chocolate, a baguette with some butter on it, or a radish, or something simple, but several different ways so that you can see how the salt interact with the different types of food, because it does interact differently with everything.
Yeah, there's one salt that's supposed to be used exclusively for fruit.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Which one is that?
I'm trying to remember.
I use all of them on fruit.
Yeah.
Well, I will try everything on anything at least once. And I certainly have my preferences, and I know things that work better. Like, for instance, Himalayan salt, which is the one that you can find everywhere, and it's, you know, in every, you know, houseware store has a jar of Himalayan salt, and that's the thing that they have, the salt blocks that are made either that. And it's very, very hard. It's very old. It's very pure. But to me, it's much, much saltier than salt that is evaporated slowly out of the seawater in the sun. So they're different, and to me, that plays a role in what I choose to use it on.
Yeah, well, anybody who wants to learn how to differentiate salts should check this book out, because you give useful information on terminology, and you name the international artisan salts, which there's so many, it's hard to believe.
I didn't even name all of them.
Oh, I mean, there's just so many. And I don't know, I'd get confused if I had them all like you have, knowing what to use where.
Well, you know, we go through phases. Like I told you, right now we're in a Murray River salt phase at my house, but we have definitely several salt cellars in the kitchen that I've really converted my whole family. So everybody has their favorite too. But I tried to, in the recipes, point out the salts that I feel work the best with the different particular recipes, because, you know, you want to have the optimal experience.
Yeah, well, I think that you outline the salt tasting so that people could actually make that an entertaining feature for a party.
For sure, yes.
Yeah, so that, and you say how to do that. Then you have a very large section on making infused salts, and I asked you why.
Well, for one thing, infused salts are really a thing now in retail settings. I see infused salts everywhere, even just in my local grocery store around the corner. The butcher now puts out infused salts on his counter that they're trying to sell. And it's nice because these salts are meant as a finishing salt more than anything else. You add them to whatever you're cooking, and when you take that first bite, you get that hit of saltiness with whatever flavor has been infused, and it can be citrus, or it could be sriracha, or it can be, you know, shiitake mushrooms, or whatever it is. And so that adds an extra element on your palate that makes your food just that much more interesting.
Well,
infused salts that are on the market are expensive, and they're very easy to make, and so for me, I much rather do it at home.
I've had a lot of experience with truffle salt, and
sure,
almost always it's not truffles at all in there, it's chemicals,
right,
simulating the truffle.
I think more often than not, when you're buying stuff that's processed and prepackaged for you, you're never guaranteed that it's going to be as pure as if you're going to do it by yourself. And honestly, I find the flavors are much more heightened when I have control over them myself. So I am all for making infused salts. And you know what? They make great gifts too.
Oh, that's
thing of infused salt to somebody instead of a bottle of wine.
That's not bad. That's a good idea.
Yeah, it's pretty easy. It's pretty cheap, and it certainly is more exciting for the hostess.
Now, one of the oldest uses of salt has been curing foods and preserving foods. So you have a curing with salt section.
Yeah. I love doing preserving. I love doing curing. And, you know, there's all types of really great and easy stuff you could do, from really simple pickles where you're just tossing the salt with cucumbers and letting them sit for 10 minutes, to more intricate, like multi-day meat preparations,
This is the one I want, bastourma. Tell me about bastourma.
So it's an Armenian dry-cured beef, and it has a lot of really great spices, but the most poignant ones to me are the fenugreek and the paprika. It's hot paprika, and it takes on this beautiful color as it sits. And you know, it involves drying and hanging in your fridge. And it, you know, it definitely is a labor of love, but I'll tell you, it's so worth it, because once you have it, you would slice it really, really thin like you would a prosciutto, and the flavor is so intense you don't need very much. So one batch will last you a long time, and I like to chop it up and put it in my scrambled eggs, or we use it in hors d'oeuvres, like instead, like you would a prosciutto, wrap it around fresh figs or stone fruits or something like that. It's really, it's so flavorful. And just, for me, it's just such a great feeling of accomplishment.
Yeah, I feel that way when I do something like that.
Yeah, to me, that's where the joy of cooking is. Just, you know, discovering things and perfecting them and just, you know, then being able to share them.
Well, there's, at the Fancy Food Show this year in New York, I didn't go to the California one, but the New York one, one of the things you couldn't ignore is that there's this huge rise in the popularity of jerky.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of jerky.
Oh, it's
there
amazing.
There is a lot of jerky. I have a couple of recipes for jerky also in this book.
Well, that's what I'm looking at, the Pipicola. Hawaiian
jerky.
Yeah,
the Hawaiian jerky. Yeah, that's great. And that's a really old preparation as well that was trail food for Hawaiian cowboys. But there's also a tuna jerky recipe, and it's so easy. And the thing that I like about these kind of recipes, too, is, you know, you can vary the flavoring as much as you want to make them to your taste, and you'll see in the jerky in the stores, and I'm sure at your fancy food show there was a zillion flavors.
Uh-huh.
And
oh, yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, you can definitely, you know, play around and get creative, and that's another great thing about working with these salts, is they really do spark your culinary creativity in ways that, you know, other foods don't.
Yeah, well, you also have a very large part of the book and recipes that show off the uses of salts. You've got snacks and hors d'oeuvres, which have to be really useful for people who entertain. You even have, I thought we were past avocado toast, but I guess not.
I know. You know, it's like it was that. Avocado toast and preserved lemons were two recipes that I know I don't think anyone needs another recipe for, but just to leave them out of a book of salt just seemed, I would be remiss. I feel if I didn't put it in. So yeah, they're in there.
Yeah,
those kind of things, especially the avocado toast or any kind of toast, right? That's a great way to really highlight these salts, because it's a perfect example of how it is, it's a feature. You know, it's a finishing touch that adds something on your palate that just, you know, your regular toast isn't going to do.
Now, I don't know where you find half these ideas for recipes. I never heard of fried green almonds.
Oh, those are so great.
I mean, I love green almonds, but frying them, that never occurred to me.
Right? Well, you know, I've been around the block a few times. I've met a lot of chefs and a lot of food people, and, you know, the people spark my creativity just as much as ingredients do, for sure.
So we go through soups and salads. We go through, let's see, what else do we have in here?
Certainly I have desserts, too.
Desserts. Yeah, I thought desserts were interesting, because the other thing that's been so popular is salted caramel.
Well, and I think, honestly, I don't, I mean, salted caramel's been around for decades, but it really, I think it's one of the things that helped spark the popularity of these sea salts and fancy salts and artisan salts. Certainly, Fleur de Sel and Maldon, these old, established salt works really started it all. And salted caramel started in France for sure, and but that's a great use for it. And if you just take that idea of sweet and salt together, you can just move on from there and come up with some really terrific uses, which, you know, hopefully I have.
Yeah, I mean, I remember my parents' generation doing the oysters on rocks salt. I hadn't seen a recipe for that in years.
Oh, yeah.
So, Well,
I used to think they only did that in places where they didn't have crushed ice.
Oh, really? You actually bake them on the salt, right?
Yeah, we did.
They're very inventive recipes. Pan-fried mackerel with grapefruit mint pesto. That sounds great.
Oh, man, that's a good one.
Yeah, I think, listeners, that you could actually learn a lot about salt, but not only that, you could probably cook your way through the rest of the book and all the exciting recipes that Leslie has provided. Leslie, thank you for producing such a great resource.
Oh, well, you're welcome. It was fun for me, and my goal in life is to get people in the kitchen trying stuff and getting creative with food. So hopefully this will inspire some people to do just that.
Yeah, well, you're an incurable educator.
I know, it's true.
But good luck with this book, Leslie.
Thank you so much.
Remember, listeners, it's called Salt.
Well, we hope you learned something important today, because we want to make sure that you do that every single week. That's why we go to all the trouble we go to bring you interesting guests, and we enjoy talking to them as well, by the way, just in case you're wondering.
That's wonderful, yeah.
So anyway, that's all for today's program. We hope you'll join us again same time, same place next week, and until then,
bye-bye.